Hello, Marco Werman here. With so much going on, it can be difficult to take a moment to pause and reflect on gratitude. We are so grateful for everyone who makes this show possible. The engineers behind the scenes, the reporters and correspondents on the ground, the editors reviewing and researching our stories, the producers making connections, finding guests, and ensuring that everything runs smoothly. And of course, you. Your support is critical. Thank you. Because of your financial support, we can run our newsroom and share with you the latest international human-centered reporting. So I'm asking for your help. From now through December 31st, we aim to raise $67,000. You can step up and donate to keep the world going strong. And to magnify the impact of your gift, a generous donor has created a match to double your contribution. If you give $100, the world will receive $200. Please head to theworld.org/give. Or visit the link in our episode notes and donate today. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks for being with the world. Now, on to the show. Hundreds of Palestinians were able to exit the Gaza Strip today and get into Egypt, but not U.S. passport holders.
We were told to wait for further instructions about the exact date and timeline within the next 24 to 72 hours.
A family awaits. I'm Marco Werman. We'll hear more from inside Gaza on the show. Also, today is the deadline for thousands of Afghans to leave Pakistan. They're now facing an uncertain future back in their home country of Afghanistan.
They are being forcibly deported to a country with absolutely no sense of stability.
And at Bletchley Park in England, an international summit convenes around the perils and promises in the rapidly advancing field of artificial intelligence.
I've become both more excited and a little more scared, I think simultaneously.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you with us this Wednesday. The Israeli military released videos showing its forces operating inside the Gaza Strip, with an army commander telling reporters that his troops are now at the gates of Gaza City. Meanwhile, airstrikes today continued under the command of the Israeli Defense Forces. The IDF says it's hit 11,000 targets in Gaza since the start of this war. The IDF also announced earlier today that 16 Israeli troops have died in combat. The Palestinian militant group Hamas that controls the Gaza Strip said that Israel bombed the Jabalia refugee camp for a second day in a row, with dozens of people killed and wounded. In the southwest corner of Gaza today at the Rafah border crossing, there was finally some movement. Ambulances were allowed through the crossing and into Egypt. Hundreds of foreign passport holders were also allowed out of Gaza. Very few U.S. citizens were on the list. But President Biden today vowed to get Americans out. That is welcome news for 36-year-old Palestinian-American Aboud Akal. In the past few weeks, you've heard his voice on our show. Akal, who's a cancer researcher when he's back home in Massachusetts, is still stuck in Rafah, just a few minutes away from the crossing to Egypt. He had traveled to Gaza on a short family vacation in late September with his wife, Awafa Abu Zeda, and their one-year-old son, Yusuf. In recent days, he says the family has been running out of food and water, crammed into a single-family home with 40 other people. Akal told The World earlier today that he heard some news last night that raised his hopes.
We were pretty excited about it. I think the first couple of hours since we heard the news, we started packing. Just a little bit past midnight, we did receive emails from the State Department letting us know that limited departures would be allowed to Rafah Crossing. So us Americans who are stranded in Gaza, a few hundreds of us, would get an assigned day and time to depart Gaza. It is not clear yet when that would happen. We were told to wait for further instructions about the exact date and timeline within the next 24 to 72 hours. But to be ready, gather our documents. I did not get much sleep. None of us did, actually, because there was a lot of shelling and bombing around the area where we're staying in Rafah. And while using the internet that we get on my cell phone through Israeli cell phone providers, just because we're near the borders, I was able to find a list of the names of foreign nationals that were planned to leave Gaza today through Rafah crossing.
That must be seriously frustrating. Was there any explanation about why departures for foreign nationals were limited in this really fraught situation?
There were none. I think that's the question that is on everyone's mind. Again, we're delighted that some people that want to leave Gaza had the chance to do so today. We're delighted about that. But again, nobody knows what the mechanism is. I think what's cleared up throughout the night, I think it was 3:30 in the morning, and it was me and my father-in-law just sitting and trying to pick up signal to read the news or to dig into more details about what the context is for which foreign national groups. And we were browsing through the lists on our phones of the names, but there's absolutely no explanation from any sources, not the State Department, not the Egyptian authorities, not the Israeli authorities, about the logic behind the selection process for the sequence of departure.
Also, Aboud, you said earlier that you've been instructed not to go to Rafah. Rafah is the only crossing into Egypt. If you're not supposed to go to Rafah, do you have any sense of where your departure would be from?
There is no way out other than Rafah crossing. At least that's what's clear to us. Although my sister, who's also an American citizen, staying with us and sheltering in Rafah with her three kids, a newborn, we're at some point at Rafah crossing, and it was an airstrike hit the Rafah crossing, and she had to flee for her life with her kids. So they're aware, I think, of the prior failed attempts, despite their instructions, and they're trying to be more cognitive now about directing us to go to Rafah crossing only when there is an absolute confirmation that we would be allowed or plan to cross. If your name is not on the list, you are not allowed to enter, which no American's name were there, at least not as foreign nationals, maybe under the umbrella of an NGO employee or an international organization employee.
Bottom line for you and your family, Aboud, today, though, still unable to get out of Gaza. What have you been seeing happening around you just today?
Yeah, that is the bottom line. We're still here, 25, 26 days into the war. We've been stranded here for now, lost count, almost over 2.5 weeks in the same house in Rafah. There's always strikes, airstrikes and shelling. We've all learned the different sounds and how to differentiate between an artillery shelling compared to an airstrike. I think everyone here in Gaza hates night time because once the sun sets, it seems to be the rhythm of bombing is intensified. And last night was a pretty intense night. I mean, where we're staying in Rafah, we've had airstrikes that hit 200, 300 feet away from the house we're sheltering in, where walls cracked, windows shattered, everyone jumped in panic. The entire neighborhood ran down the street, everyone thinking that the airstrike hit the roof of their house. That's how loud it was.
Right.
With all of this, I think what we're trying to do is mentally we're trying to balance us departing and heading back home and our life that we've left behind, and at the same time trying to kind of shield our son as much as we can from this, and trying to minimize, because I think we're past the point where it would have no impact on him. We're trying to minimize the impact on him. We see changes in his behavior, and certainly physically he's experienced the wrath of the war by at least not being able to get his milk. We ran out of milk for him a few days ago, and that's been his main source of nutrition. So that's been taken away from him. And now our latest struggle is really with supplying resources for the entire household that we're staying at, 40 people sheltering in one place. Desalination stations and filtration stations have almost nearly completely shut down in Gaza.
What is your one-year-old boy drinking if there's no milk or water right now?
We get a gallon of water a day for 40 people.
1 gallon of water per day for 40 people.
1 gallon of water a day for 40 people. We were so fortunate today that a friend of ours was able to secure us a second gallon that would take off the pressure from tomorrow. But today has been 3 days in a row where basically we're out of drinking water. And to keep things fair, they only allow each person to fill up only 1 gallon. And we try to control the portions. We prioritize the young ones and the elders. And in some days, actually, we've had to drink what's referred to here as salt water. This is water that's not processed, basically raw out of the wells, because we couldn't secure any drinking water.
Yeah, a gallon divided by 40 people, that is a small fraction of the UN mandated minimum of water for human survival. Aboud, there are at least 400 U.S. citizens in your position stuck in Gaza. Are you confident that you're a priority for the U.S. government?
We'd like to think in our heads that we are. We hear Secretary Blinken, we hear President Biden mention that we are their top priority, but we don't see that translating into actions. Again, my wife and I would like to think that as American citizens, our U.S. administration, especially one that I have voted for, have actually our best interest and safety being their top priority, yet we've had our doubts.
Massachusetts resident Aboud Akal, along with his wife and one-year-old son, they're among 400 U.S. passport holders stranded in Gaza. Aboud joined us from the city of Rafah on the Gaza side. Aboud, thank you very much for speaking with us, and take care.
Happy to do that, Marco. Fingers crossed we get out soon.
Thousands of miles away from the Rafah crossing, there's another border that's getting international attention today. That's the one between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Since the Taliban took over Afghanistan, tens of thousands of Afghans have fled to Pakistan. Now, Pakistan's government says anyone without proper documents has to leave. It set a deadline for today. But as the world's Shirin Jafari reports, for many Afghans, going back to their home country is not an option.
Khalasa Aminzadeh received a message from her landlord this week that she has only 2 days to vacate her apartment in Islamabad. The message, which she shared with me, reads, "Sorry to say, but you're illegal here. You need to get a new visa, otherwise I can't help you." Aminzadeh says she doesn't know what to do. "I can't imagine going back to Afghanistan," she says, "and I have nowhere else to go." In Afghanistan, Aminzadeh took part in protests and advocated for women's rights. Her father, she says, was a general in the army and was beheaded by the Taliban. After the fall of the U.S.-backed government in August 2021, the Taliban raided her home and threatened her, she says. She went into hiding. Last year, she managed to flee to Pakistan. And there, she began to build a new life for herself. She works 3 jobs, she says, teaching chemistry and biology at a school for Afghan children, also teaching online and working at a convenience store at night. "We Afghans are not in Pakistan by choice," she says. "We were forced out of our own home. I begged the Pakistani government not to deport us." Sabiha Khan is with the NGO Refugees International. She says since October 4th, when the Pakistani government issued the order, Afghans have been targeted.
"We were hearing from Afghans in Pakistan about increased police harassment, about landlords, you know, refusing to rent to them, employers refusing to continue to hire them."
Khan explains that around 20,000 Afghans in Pakistan are waiting to be resettled elsewhere, like in the U.S., Canada, and Germany. And the process has just been extremely slow.
"Tens of thousands of these people worked alongside Americans, and they had the promise of support from the U.S. government and other international partners. And so far, they have not followed through."
Some people in Pakistan are protesting the government's plan to expel Afghans. At this rally in Karachi, recorded by the Associated Press over the weekend, one sign reads, "Sending Afghans back to Afghanistan is a death sentence."
"It is really an injustice, the fact that they are being forcibly deported to a country with absolutely no sense of stability."
Sarah Wahidi is the founder of Ehtesab. It's an app that provides real-time emergency information to people in Afghanistan.
"We are seeing that in Afghanistan, in the context of women, for example, all you can do is breathe and exist. That is all that has been left."
The Taliban have banned women and girls from getting an education beyond the 6th grade. Women also can't work in most sectors. For its part, the Pakistani government says the influx of refugees has worsened the security conditions in the country. It has also blamed Afghans for a series of suicide attacks, but it hasn't provided any evidence. Meanwhile, as today's deadline approached, more than 10,000 Afghans rushed to the border. Videos posted online showed trucks loaded with furniture and families' belongings lining up at the border crossing. Women and children rested on the ground in the shade of the giant truck tires. The Taliban said today that those who have left the country for political reasons can return to Afghanistan. It also denied Pakistan's claim that Afghans have created security problems in Pakistan. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Today is the Day of the Dead, a holiday widely celebrated in Mexico when people remember loved ones who've passed away. Just ahead, how the increasing popularity of the holiday is boosting sales of one particular flower. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Bletchley Park, it's the famous countryside estate where Alan Turing and his team of codebreakers cracked the Nazi code, Enigma, during World War II. They used a computer, a very rudimentary computer by today's standards, to do it. Since then, human knowledge and computing power have come a long way and potentially out of our control, or at least that is the worry. That's why experts from around the world are gathering at Bletchley Park right now to discuss, among other things, ways to control AI, artificial intelligence. Samir Jain is a vice president of policy at the Center for Democracy and Technology, a think tank based in Washington and Brussels. Samir, who's taking part in this Bletchley Park meeting?
It's really a wide variety of people, people from the government, people from leading AI companies, experts in research, as well as civil society groups, all stakeholders coming together to talk about what should we do in terms of addressing some of the potential harms and risks from artificial intelligence, even as we recognize that it can bring a lot of benefits.
And what's most likely to come out of it? Anything concrete?
You know, I think we will see a statement or a communique from the various governments outlining some of the plans that they agree to with respect to steps forward, from testing AI systems to mitigating risks to making sure they don't create harms like discrimination. It really caught the world by storm when ChatGPT got released, and all of a sudden everyone could see right in front of their faces this artificial intelligence system seemingly conversing just like a human. And I think that brought to everyone's attention, including policymakers, that, hey, there's this really powerful technology that's being deployed, and while it has plenty of potential benefits for health or education, there are also some real risks here that we need to deal with and make sure that we get ahead of, maybe in ways that we didn't with social media.
Well, President Biden issued an executive order on AI, and given that the U.S. has been slow compared to Europe's vigilance around AI, I'm wondering how important that executive order is, especially in terms of AI standards for the international community.
I think it's quite a critical executive order, very comprehensive, and it really calls on all agencies across the government to get involved and to take steps to address some of the potential harms, you know, whether that's in the use of AI to monitor workers, whether it's the use of AI to engage in screening of tenants in potentially discriminatory ways, or ways in which it can be used in education and making sure that's done responsibly, as well as to protect privacy, to make sure that the next generation of these models don't get out of control and create significant risks, whether it's, you know, in cybersecurity or potentially even creating or helping to create biological or chemical weapons.
Samir, are there countries maybe even attending this Bletchley Park summit right now that demonstrate a willingness to use AI in draconian, even repressive ways?
Well, certainly you see that the use of AI and other technologies in a country like China, for example, in ways that really do involve a lot of surveillance of their citizens, you know, everything from ubiquitous use of facial recognition to social capital and things like that. And one of the important leadership goals here for the United States and other like-minded democracies is to say, hey, you know, we too want to innovate around AI, but it needs to be done in a rights-respecting, responsible way.
Right. Samir, I'm curious. You watch AI and the policy around it. How have your personal feelings changed, if at all, since ChatGPT first came out?
I've become both more excited and a little more scared, I think simultaneously. Excited because we do really see AI as potentially bringing forth a lot of great developments in the area of health, for example. You know, whether we were talking about the use of generative AI to create mis- and disinformation, or the possibility that it exacerbates existing discrimination against marginalized communities, those are real risks, and they're current risks.
Samir Jain is the Vice President of Policy at the Center for Democracy and Technology. Samir, really appreciate your insight here. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Day of the Dead celebrations are underway today in Mexico and throughout the United States. The global flower industry has been gearing up for this holiday with marigolds, those bright orange blossoms used to decorate family altars and commemorate loved ones who've died. From station KQED in San Francisco, Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman reports that in recent years, the marigold business has just taken off.
The air smells sweet inside the San Francisco flower market. Colors explode out of buckets of flowers on the floor.
Oh, I like that one.
We like that one.
These two?
Yeah.
Wedding planners and florists are combing the aisles in search of the best flowers. And it's the season for marigolds, grown in places like Salinas and Watsonville.
Tommy, allá la señora tiene una pregunta.
Lupe Rico is a second-generation flower farmer. He says at his farm in Colma, he grew 3,000 bunches of marigolds this year. That's about 30,000 flowers.
This year we grow a lot because we always get short. I say we're going to put some more this year, see what happens.
In the week leading up to the holiday, he says his crew will start cutting their crop like crazy, and the market will fill up with marigolds.
You're going to see orange everywhere.
Many people in the flower industry say sales of marigolds have gone up over the past few years. One grower in San Diego County sold 40,000 more marigolds in 2017 than the year before. One reason? The 2017 Disney film Coco, about Day of the Dead.
But my great-grandma Coco's father was the greatest musician of all time.
And I will say, this is kind of funny, but I will say after Coco, the increase of people for the Mexican traditional Day of the Dead, it's been like so popular.
Raul Duenas works for Rafa Wholesale Flowers here at the SF Market. He says that rise in popularity has kept going. They've sold 2,000 more bunches of marigolds this year compared to last.
I was reached by several hotels requesting marigolds arrangements. So that tells me also the interest of those, the course, like any other holiday, it's been increasing.
The market for cut flowers worldwide is expected to be valued at $46.5 billion by 2027.
Ecuador has really kind of taken over a lot of the traditional, quote-unquote, California-ish items.
That's Alexander Peter Bodeman. He runs Peter Alexander's Inc., which has been importing and selling flowers for 25 years. He says the amount of flower farms in California has dropped, and that means an increased supply of flowers is coming in from abroad. Local florists like Mauricio Vivas buy marigolds at the SF Flower Market. He owns Tony Rossi and Sons Flower Shop in Oakland's Fruitvale neighborhood.
Our sales probably go up maybe about, I'll say about 10%. It's not that much of an increase in our sales just because of the price of the flower. It's not a very expensive flower.
A bunch of marigolds goes for $10 to $15, where a bunch of roses sells for more than twice that amount. But Vivas says it's worth having the flowers on hand.
It brings people and then they buy something else that we have at the store.
Things like papel picado or candles. Rivas says marigolds sold here will end up in community altars and private ones in the neighborhood. Lupe Rico, the grower from Colma, is making an altar for his late father who died this year. He worked alongside him at their farm for over 40 years.
So when I cut in right now, I say, Dad, I cut in your ear. The flowers you used to cut.
He says that helps him remember his dad.
For The World, I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman in San Francisco.
It's one of Europe's smallest countries with a national leader who's also a Catholic bishop, and that's why there's a strict ban against abortion in Andorra.
It's not normal that Andorra is the only country in Europe that cannot have abortion. So today we are here for that.
Pushing back against the abortion ban and the church in Andorra. That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Yesterday, Secretary of State Antony Blinken tried to make the case to a Senate committee for more aid to Israel and Ukraine.
Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today.
Protesters repeatedly interrupted the proceedings, calling for an end to Israeli bombing in Gaza. But later in his remarks, Blinken talked about a possible revitalized Palestinian Authority retaking control of the Gaza Strip after Israel topples Hamas. The West Bank is the larger of the two Palestinian territories. The Palestinian Authority, or the PA, in the West Bank is backed by the international community and the U.S. But after Hamas violently took over the Gaza Strip in 2007, the PA has not had much sway there. We wanted to explore where the PA and the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, fit into the larger picture. So we reached out to Noor Odeh. She's a Palestinian political activist, researcher, and author. She's based in Ramallah in the West Bank. Noor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What is your initial reaction to Antony Blinken's suggestion that a revitalized Palestinian Authority could take over in Gaza if Israel succeeds in toppling Hamas?
Well, I've been generally quite frustrated and dismayed by Antony Blinken's statements throughout this crisis and by the oversimplistic policy, really, line that the Biden administration has taken.
Yeah, why is getting the authority for the Palestinian people, the Palestinian Authority, to take over in Gaza, why do you see that as a simplistic solution?
No, I see the rhetoric of finishing off Hamas, of eliminating Hamas, oversimplistic. This is a group that was founded in 1989. And it's a political group as much as it has an armed wing. And it doesn't only exist in Gaza. So it's not as simple as, okay, let's completely decimate the Gaza Strip in the name of fighting Hamas. Let's kill off a few leaders. And then we'll bring in the PA off the back of an Israeli tank and tell them, here, take over this disaster zone, rebuild it with some foreign money, and everything will be okay. That's, again, oversimplistic, and it will not achieve the stated desired outcome.
How far apart, in fact, just politically, are these two groups, Hamas in Gaza and the PA under President Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank, in terms of what they want for Palestinians?
There are serious political differences and ideological differences. The PA is not one group. The PA represents a Palestinian political spectrum of mostly secular Palestinian factions that have adopted the ultimate goal of realizing sovereignty over a Palestinian state on the West Bank and Gaza, including East Jerusalem. Hamas at one point also tried to adopt the same line, believe it or not, and it was shunned away. Nobody really wanted to give it a chance to normalize or get into the political process. Palestinians, by and large, despite the political divide between their factions, are not divided. You might disagree on their politics. You might have people who are more left-leaning, more progressive, more secular, and others who are more conservative. But overall, there is Palestinian consensus about the need to end Israel's rule over their life, Israel's control over their territory, and to see sovereignty and freedom realized.
Noor Odeh, what role can the Palestinian Authority play now in this conflict, if any?
Well, look, I think when the dust settles, what needs to happen is that the Palestinian Authority needs to have a moment of reflection, domestic reflection. The whole political setup needs to be reconstituted in a way that unites everybody, that is inclusive, that is representative, and that is built on national consensus and not on international or American priorities.
But right now, Noor, in this moment, do Palestinians on the West Bank, do they want their government to do something about this war, to take a stand or broker a peace agreement, anything?
Absolutely. They expect the government to do everything it can and more to end this war, to bring about a ceasefire, to provide their fellow Palestinians with all the assistance that they need. Again, this is one family. We are a small nation. And every family that suffers loss in Gaza has relatives here or friends and loved ones here. So the pain, the sense of grief is not confined to Gaza, and the expectation that the Palestinian Authority would be engaged as it is to bring about an end to this war is very high. And they will continue to feel that not enough is done until the bombs stop falling on homes in Gaza.
But so far, the PA government hasn't really done anything, has it?
Well, the limited space in which it can maneuver, which is the diplomatic space, the PA has worked with other countries at the United Nations. They were the driving force behind the General Assembly resolution adopted by 120 countries to calling for a ceasefire. They've been in talks also with the Security Council members, including the U.S., to come up with an acceptable resolution that can be enforced. You know, there have been other diplomatic efforts, but again, it seems almost like an impossible task when you have countries with such influence like the U.S. who have apparently made the decision that this war will go on as long as Israel decides, no matter the cost.
But why does the Palestinian public have such little confidence in PA leadership under Mahmoud Abbas?
Because there haven't been any elections, and because the Palestinian political system, in its attempt to maintain Western support, has been pushed into adopting extremely unpopular policies. Those policies include cooperating with the occupier when that is seen as something that is very humiliating and very counterproductive. I don't want to put all the blame on the outside world, but certainly as an observer, as somebody who's seen this unfold since 2006, I can tell you without hesitation that a big component of the continued rift in Palestinian politics has been international intervention and this drive to kind of call the shots. We need to have a unified political system where everybody is included, where all voices are heard and equally respected, and where everybody is accountable to the Palestinian voter and nobody else.
Noor Odeh is a Palestinian political activist, researcher, and author. She's been speaking with us from Ramallah in the West Bank. Noor, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Andorra is a tiny nation in the Pyrenees Mountains between Spain and France. It's one of Europe's smallest and least populated countries, and notably the only one with a total ban on abortion. Changing that would challenge Andorra's entire system of government. Reporter Alain Ruiz Terol recently traveled there to hear the stories of people who have struggled to get access to abortion and why changing the law would be so difficult.
One weekend this fall, 100 people march in Andorra for the right to abortion. 22-year-old Noelia Bustamante is one of them.
It's not normal that Andorra is the only country in Europe that cannot have abortion. So today we are here for that.
Bustamante is one of the very few locals here.
I think the most part of the women today are from Spain and France, not so much from Andorra.
Among the protesters who are actually from Andorra, some don't want to give their names and cover their faces for the photos. Bustamante explains.
Everyone is scared here and they don't want to go outside and talk about it. People, they don't want to have like problems with the church, with the president here, and I think it's because of that.
The church is indeed the target of many slogans at the rally, like this. If the Pope were a woman, abortion would be legal. Catholic doctrine holds that life begins at conception and that abortion is a sin. In Andorra, the church is uniquely positioned to turn this doctrine into policy.
There is like a bishop here. And because of him, we cannot have abortion here, because the church at the end, so it's because of that.
She's referring to the Bishop of Urgell, the co-prince and head of state of Andorra. It's a title shared with the French president, a remnant of an old feudal treaty. While their role is symbolic, the legal ban on abortion is a result of the bishop's will. If abortion were legalized, the Vatican has said the bishop would have to step down as prince of Andorra. This would cause a constitutional crisis and put an end to a centuries-old tradition. While Andorra is a country, it can feel like a small town. People know each other, and some worry that challenging the way things are could get you in trouble.
No tengo vergüenza, es más miedo de que.
This is Vanessa. She agreed to share her experience having an abortion on the condition of using only her first name. It's not out of shame, she says, but out of fear.
Soy temporera, porque en invierno estoy en pista de monitora.
She's a ski instructor during Andorra's busy winter season, which attracts tourists and migrant workers like Vanessa, who is French. A few years ago, she and her partner got pregnant.
Tomamos la decisión de que mejor lo abortamos y bueno, claro, en Andorra ya sabía que evidentemente.
She decided to have an abortion and knew that was not possible in Andorra. She looked for abortion clinics in France. The closest she found was an hour and a half away by car. She went there 3 times.
Eso me pareció poco doloroso, ¿sabes? No poder estar en su casa.
It was painful having to travel for hours and not being able to be at home, she said. But at least at the French clinic, she felt taken care of and didn't have to pay, which made the hassle more bearable.
Yo no me siento para nada traumatizada. Creo que es una ayuda.
I don't feel traumatized at all, she says, and adds that being raised in an environment where abortion is accepted can take some weight off your shoulders. Others have a different experience.
Yo siempre decía que el aborto no era una opción.
This is Sandra, who also didn't want to use her last name. She was raised to believe abortion was not an option, and even had an unplanned baby at the age of 19. Years later, another unexpected pregnancy changed her view.
No era el moment. Es que no era el moment de cap de las maneras, pero en la gafesis, ¿no? Si,
it was not the right time, no by any means, she says. She already had 2 children and was afraid of being alone with a baby, 1 salary and an apartment to pay. It could have been a catastrophe, she said.
Me pregunta a una llevadora y en realidad que no. Que
her world fell apart when the midwife told her she could not have an abortion in Andorra. She traveled to Barcelona, a 3-hour drive. At the clinic, she had a terrible time and felt mistreated. The bill was 500 euros. Sandra now thinks abortions should be accessible and carried out in the best possible conditions. And even if they're not legal, she says Andorra could still do more, like provide transportation or psychological assistance.
No es solo el hecho de bajar. Es todo lo de antes y lo de después.
It's not only the abortion itself. There's the before and the aftermath, she says. The fact is, Andorra does have a reproductive health service. It provides information about abortion clinics abroad, but it does not cover the cost or the travel. Where the state falls short, activists are stepping in. Vanessa Mendoza Cortés is a psychologist and the founder of the women rights and support group Stop Violencias. Some years ago, a woman came asking for help. She was being abused and was pregnant after being raped. She wanted an abortion but had no money. It was the first such case they encountered. They contacted reproductive health groups in Barcelona to find an abortion clinic. They got her on a bus, provided economic support, and found someone to accompany her at all times. This became the seed of an informal abortion network known as Xarxa La Meri. Every year, they help around 50 women get abortions.
Nosaltres ens ha passat acompanyar alguna dona a la privada.
We've been to an abortion clinic in Barcelona on a Saturday morning and found 8 women from Andorra in the waiting room, she says. It's nearly impossible to know how many leave Andorra every year for an abortion, but she says it's probably in the hundreds or even thousands. Mendoza has galvanized the abortion movement in Andorra and is a vocal critic who says institutions are not protecting women. But her outspokenness has had repercussions. This December, Mendoza will stand trial for defamation after criticizing the country before the United Nations. She faces a 12,000 euro fine.
Quan em denuncia el govern el 2019, jo volia desaparèixer.
When the government reported her back in 2019, she wanted to hide under a stone and disappear. But instead, she doubled down. The government maintains that Mendoza is not being prosecuted for her activism, but for making false accusations. Human rights groups, though, like Amnesty and the UN, stand by her and call the charges disproportionate. All in all, the case has further exposed Andorra's conflicted approach towards abortion. Even the government now admits that change is due, says the Minister of Institutional Relations, Ladislau Baró. Of course we're concerned. We're aware of society's demands, he says. And Andorran society is becoming ever more secular, like elsewhere in Europe. The government is discussing the matter with the bishop and even the Vatican and expects some progress over the next 4 years. But Baró says the road is narrow.
Estem intentant trobar la compatibilitat.
We're trying to find the balance between decriminalizing abortion and not authorizing it, he said. This poses a legal conundrum. 30 years ago, when Andorra passed its constitution, the right to life was widely protected, as requested by the bishop himself. While the government wants to get rid of the crime of abortion, legalizing it may require a constitutional reform, which is off the table. If we want to keep Andorra's institutions, we can't make this next step, at least for now, he says. Meanwhile, Andorrans will continue to travel abroad to end the pregnancy. And some are getting tired of waiting for things to change. Nairai Busquets was born and raised in Andorra, but recently moved to a little village in Catalonia, where we met. She had long been fed up with the cost of living and the lack of opportunities. But this year, having to leave her country for an abortion was a tipping point.
It's molt injust, molt injust.
It's so unfair, she said. What you're going through is hard enough, and on top of that, you are forced to do it far from home. She gets emotional remembering that the baby would have been due this October, around the time of her birthday. Back in Andorra, many people still don't know she had an abortion, but to break the taboo, she decided to open up.
Sí, tinc 24 anys, em dic Nairai i he abortat. Què passa? Passa res.
I'm 24 years old, my name is Nairai, and I had an abortion. And that's okay, she says. Nairai feels the country where she's lived all her life hasn't changed since she was born.
Espero que algún día pugui canviar. Me sentiría molt orgullosa.
I hope things do change someday, she says. I would feel proud and thankful. In the meantime, she will wait from abroad. For The World, I'm Alan Ruiz Terol, Andorra.
This story is part of our Sacred Nation series looking at the role of religion and nationalism around the globe. Explore more reporting on our website, theworld.org/sacrednation. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. You'll remember this story about the FSO Safar, the oil storage vessel anchored off the coast of Yemen.
Just off the coast sits a decaying oil tanker, ready to burst.
On board are more than 1.1 million barrels of oil.
That could leave nearly 8 million people without water.
Thankfully, earlier this year, international help spearheaded by the United Nations prevented a disaster. But around the globe, there are other stationary oil storage tankers posing the same threat. Associated Press reporter Helen Wiefering led an investigation into one similar situation. She joins us from Washington. Helen, tell us about the vessel, the Trinity Spirit, that was floating off the coast of Nigeria. What happened to it?
So this ship was very similar to the Safar in the sense that it stored oil off the coast of Nigeria, and it had been there for more than two decades in the same location with, in its late years, very little maintenance. What happened was that last February, it exploded. The whole ship went up in flames. Luckily, you might say, there wasn't as much oil on this ship as there was the Safar, but still, 40,000 barrels spilled, and also seven people we believe were killed. Five were killed, two were unaccounted for.
It was a horrible accident. As you say, people died. What was the wider impact on Nigerians?
Well, first of all, this ship spilled 40,000 barrels of oil into the Niger Delta, which is already a very polluted place. Local communities in Ondo State and Delta State wrote petitions to the environmental department saying that this spill impacted their livelihoods. But what we really followed in our story was the impact on these three survivors. They were men who had this harrowing night where they woke up to this explosion and jumped off the ship and were miraculously rescued by these fishermen. And they have a lot of complaints with how the ship was run in its final years, and they say they weren't paid and rarely had enough food. So our story also followed the lasting impacts of this explosion on those three men.
Yeah, pretty stunning. These are stationary vessels. They look like ships, but they don't travel, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. They are used to kind of extract oil from the ocean floor, store it, and offload it onto tankers that might then bring the oil into the supply chain. But because they stay in place, it kind of means that these ships just don't get seen as much by other authorities or port officials. We believe there's less oversight of these ships just because, you know, they can stay in the same place for, you know, in some cases, decades.
Right. So who ultimately is responsible for those ships?
We found that a lot of it falls just on the ship owners and the local governments. These ships do operate within national waters, so there's limited authority by the United Nations or the International Maritime Organization, which did step in with the SAFR, but in large part because I think of the unrest in Yemen.
Right. Where else in the world are ships like the Trinity Spirit posing a danger?
We found there are about 240 still operating around the world, but some of the oldest are concentrated on the coast of Brazil, on the west coast of Africa, and also in Southeast Asia. One of the oldest that we're aware of is called Al-Zafarana. It's located off the coast of Egypt. But there is another ship just 200 miles south of where the Trinity Spirit caught fire called the Mistras, which was built in the same year. It's 47 years old now. We're unsure of what shape the ship is in, and it seems as if it's not being watched very closely.
According to your report, in that 240 ships, there are some 30 vessels that are even older than the Trinity Spirit?
Yes, that's correct. And I do want to be clear that not every old vessel might explode tomorrow. That maintenance is a big factor here in terms of how long a ship can keep running. But what we found is because these ships don't move, they're also not getting repairs that you might get in port because, you know, it's expensive for a company to stop operating and remove that ship from its operating location.
Yeah. Helen, how many years is a tanker hull expected to last without maintenance?
Without maintenance, our sources, including Rystad Energy, say those ships are built generally for about 25 years.
I mean, the concept overall of these floating storage and offloading units, or FSOs as they're known in the industry, among people who know, like engineering experts, what do they think of these? Are they considered a best practice when it comes to oil production?
They are actually increasingly a popular choice. A lot of the oil production development is taking place in deeper waters. And these FPSOs and FSOs are very useful for producing oil off there.
So as it become more popular, what's being done either locally or at an international level to prevent accidents like the one you reported on in Nigeria with the Trinity Spirit?
Well, the industry appears to have picked up on the growing age of these vessels. The American Bureau of Shipping is one company that inspects these ships and helps keep them up to code. And I believe they're updating some of their standards in terms of what should be required and what should be maintained as these ships get into an older age. But there is still no international retirement age for these ships. It really comes to the discretion of, again, the local regulator and the ship owner. And I can only say that I think the SAFR has brought a lot of attention to the risks these ships posed, and I hope the Trinity Spirit will add to that as well.
Helen Wiefering is a reporter on the Global Investigations team at the Associated Press, telling us about their research into oil storage tankers and the serious problems they present as they age. Helen, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Marco.
In Tanzania today, an apology came from a former colonial ruler. German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier is visiting the East African country, which had been a German colony from 1885 until the First World War. Also today, Steinmeier met descendants of a Tanzanian chief, Songea Mbano, who led a revolt against German rule and was executed in 1906. Steinmeier told them that he mourned the chief and others who were executed. He then went further.
Deutscher Bundespräsident, möchte ich um Verzeihung bitten für das, was Deutsche hier ihren Vorfahren.
As German president, I would like to apologize for what Germans did to your forefathers, Steinmeier said. In separate comments, the president told reporters that it's important for people, especially Germans, to know about the country's history in Tanzania.
Und dass wir Formen finden, in denen wir gemeinsam mit dieser belastenden Vergangenheit.
We need to find ways to deal with the burden of the past together, he said. That audio courtesy of German broadcaster Deutsche Welle. As we reported yesterday, Britain's King Charles III is in neighboring Kenya this week. Charles has not apologized to Kenyans for Britain's colonial rule there, though he did acknowledge the atrocities that Kenyans suffered in their fight for independence 60 years ago. That is The World on this Wednesday. We come to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow. Marco here. Before we go, just a reminder that right now The World is holding our fall fundraising drive. Your support is critical. It powers our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting. Our goal is to raise $67,000 before the end of the year. Every gift counts. please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and donate. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much, and be well.